And I'm delighted to welcome you and Caitlin Saloom to her talk this evening. Caitlin Saloom, as you probably know, is Associate Professor at NYU. And Caitlin really needs very little introduction at all. She is well known for her pioneering work as an anthropologist amongst the speculators or amongst the stock traders. And she also needs very little introduction, actually, at LSE. She's been part of our intellectual community since 2000, when you were visiting fellow in the Cities Programme. It was actually during that time that she was doing her fieldwork in the London Stock Exchange. And actually, Caitlin last night pointed out to me the office where she used to come in Corpus to recover from the highs and lows of speculation in the stock market. So. And the book that came out of that project was the very widely read Out of the Pits that was published by Chicago University Press in 2006. And that book has also had a huge influence and has been very widely reviewed in some places as diverse as the London Review of Books, to American Ethnologists, to Business History Review. And this, you know, I think is emblematic of the importance of Caitlin's work. She's very much an anthropologist, but her work speaks to this wide public audience. And actually, Caitlin was just telling me now that she's taking this role, she's bringing this role of being a public intellectual more widely to anthropologists. She's about a senior editor of Public Culture. She's about to launch a new journal that's part of Public Culture called, what is it?
Public Books.
Public Books. And this is going to be a place where the intellectual public can read about the work of public intellectuals. So this is, you know, very emblematic of Caitlin's strengths. So tonight we're going to hear about Caitlin's most recent work, which has been amongst evangelical Christians in the States. And I'll give you the title of your talk is God's Money Managers, Evangelical Finance and Dependent Rationality.
Thank you, Laura, for a very nice introduction. It's always nice to be back at the LSE, especially since the LSE had such a formative place in my own research, as Laura was mentioning, after my first book was about derivatives traders in Chicago and here in the city, and when I wasn't going to bars with traders after work to do more field work, I would actually come here to the office right across from the old curiosity shop and try to write my field notes. So it's always a bit of a bit of coming home to be here. So I'm especially glad to be able to introduce my new project here, which is a study of a set of emergent revisions of liberalism, particularly those that address the failures of rational action. I'm especially interested in the project in sites which are using the knowledge of these failures to produce reasoned forms of action, sites of what I call reflexive rationality. So they're using knowledge of failure to produce rationality as an effect. And a part of this project examines the growing sphere of financial experts that address the particular failures generated by what I call the paradox of personal finance. And that's the expectation, particularly, of course, in the US, that household heads should act as experts in the manipulation of complex financial instruments and models with which to secure their family futures and also to achieve aspirations that used to be considered broadly middle class, like college education and secure retirement. So today I'm going to discuss an unusual set of experts who work with both individuals and families to achieve what looks like rational economic conduct, and that's the financial ministries of American evangelical churches. As I was mentioning, my earlier work in finance focused on financial derivatives traders, so this was a significant shift in sights for me. And also one that I hope will help shift some of the focus in the anthropology of finance and social studies of finance, which had focused almost exclusively on the professional field of finance. especially with great attention devoted to processes of economic calculation. And my my first book was definitely part of that movement. So for those of you who are less familiar with the field, formal models like the Black-Scholes options pricing model, the contribution of economists and technologies used by financial traders, have received extensive attention, some by some people in the room. I believe that investigating objects instead of at the center but at the margins of the formal profession will generate insights that can move beyond and perhaps pose challenges to the financial field's own definitions and logic. So I think that going to a site that seems, maybe this is a classic anthropological trope, but going outside the field's center will actually produce insights about its center. So now I'll start to tell you a little bit about evangelical financial ministries. Evangelicals in the United States began developing financial ministries about 30 years ago. In churches across the country, financial ministers now counsel their church members to lift themselves from debt and from the ungodly world's economic values by submitting to God's purpose in their lives and engaging biblical ideas of spending and saving. The financial ministries that I worked with promote a very standard form of economic rationality at the household level. They want you to balance income and expenditures and to plan for large-scale future expenses like college education, home purchases, and retirement, all of those milestones. The results of their intervention resemble the calculations of a responsible, autonomous liberal subject. How financial ministries achieve this rationality, however, departs markedly from the ideas of self and self-management that undergird economic thinking outside of the church. The black ink on these believers' budgets inscribes a thoroughly evangelical notion, and that's that economic freedom is written under God's influence. Financial ministries position Jesus' companionship as a way for church members to adjust themselves to the market landscape of financial dips and spikes and to the emotional volatility of consumer desire and social comparison ever present in the economic environment of the United States. To do this, religious cum financial advisors develop an understanding of human rationality as both insufficient and fragile, and stress humans' entanglements with social and environmental influence. Their explanations actually often sound remarkably akin to Thorsten Veblen's. They also relate to another and much more recent and much more actually local set of economic thinkers. Behavioral economists such as Daniel Kahneman and Richard Thaler. Financial ministers and behavioral economists both pose remarkably similar critiques of rational action. As you might imagine, though, their ethical commitments and strategies for intervention remain quite distinct. However, if we think them together, they begin to draw a picture of a novel practice of liberal rationality. My talk will focus on the evangelical fieldwork that I conducted, but will end by suggesting the significance of the parallel development. Okay. Slide right here. Okay. Well, this isn't quite as contrasty as it might be, but it's a bit of an introduction to, or will help me introduce the fieldwork that I conducted for this research. I worked in evangelical megachurches in the Bay Area, one of which is this one pictured here, which is called Abundant Life. In Mountain View, California. And if Mountain View rings a bell, it's because it's also where the headquarters of Google is, and this is actually not completely incidental. And this is Pastor Paul Shepherd, who is somewhat unusual as an evangelical preacher of a megachurch by being African-American. But as you can see, this Abundant Life, it's ALCF, Abundant Life Christian Fellowship, and Abundant Life has many marks of the traditional megachurch, such as, an absolutely enormous sanctuary that can hold about 1,000 people, which they pack regularly during weekend services. And this is in sort of a meta commentary. They also always have PowerPoint presentations, which is both a convenient way to display images and song lyrics, but which is also very consistent with the kind of corporate imagery that evangelical Christianity in America has been developing since the 1980s. So I just wanted to point that out. So Abundant Life is only one of the churches which I worked with, but it's the most important one because it had the most well-developed financial counseling ministry. It had 60 biblical budget counselors on site, and a continuous rotation of scripturally based financial Bible study classes, and also Pastor Paul's sermons often touch on the conflict between American spending values and evangelical life. Abundant Life also holds meetings to train Christian budget coaches. That's what they call them, apparently, because men will go to coaches, but they won't go to advisors. The Abundant Life Ministry actually trains Christian budget coaches for churches, at both big churches and small churches across the region. So it's kind of a hub for this. And there I both attended Sunday services and participated in the weekly Bible study sessions with intensive involvement with the budget coaching piece of the ministry as well. The financial ministry was composed of two main parts. First, the Bible study classes, and also budget coaching. The Bible study classes, the financially focused Bible study classes, met every Sunday right after services in the kind of low-lying office park that is right across the street from what is the larger, more warehouse-like structure where this sanctuary is located. And the sessions were a hybrid of a class and the kind of small group study that megachurches are famous for. Megachurches often, if you don't know, foster very small, intimate meetings with church members outside of church in order to kind of create communities within this huge body of members that they have. Two church volunteers ran the Bible study session, both giving support through their own stories of financial rebirth and also just attending to the everyday functioning. After about 20 participants took their seats, these volunteers would go up to the front and queue up a DVD with a celebrity pastor. Rick Warren, for instance, who's a very famous pastor in the U.S., would call on biblical passages to inspire us to make God's word the basis of our spending and saving. We'd watch the video and write along in our workbooks when the pastor would direct us to write. After the video, we'd break into smaller groups and discuss our own budgeting processes and struggles with making our finances relate to belief, and then pray together on money issues. Apart from Bible study, budget coaches actually met with church members one-on-one to do the more in-depth work of marrying scriptural guidance and cash flow problems. And talking to the budget coaches provided a more fine-grained look into the cause of the financial problems and the uses of godly counsel. Before I go farther, I want to tell you what sort of evangelicals these are. So I don't know if these two men look familiar to any of you, but they are representatives of a very particular and very, very popular brand of evangelical Christianity in the U.S. today. And Rick Warren, who I just mentioned, is especially important in this. He actually gave the convocation at President Obama's inauguration, just to give you an example of what kind of prominence Rick Warren has. And so he also runs a very powerful church in Southern California called the Saddleback Church that has tens of thousands of members, and he's a very, the author of one of the best-selling books in the world, which you've probably likely not heard of, called The Purpose-Driven Life. But his approach, which is very much based on a set of middle-class aesthetics, is very much what the ministries that I'm talking about are aligned with. And Dave Ramsey is the sort of popular popular media celebrity whose television shows and financial peace universities and many books are sold and heard all across the United States. He is also very much an evangelical as well. And here are the people that they are not aligned with. The financial ministries that I work with are very concerned that they are not aligned with the people, the preachers of the prosperity gospel. And most people assume that when I start talking about evangelical finance, that's what I'm talking about. So I just want to put that up there to say this is not it. So I would say that Joel Osteen and Creflo Dollar are the weak and strong versions of the prosperity gospel, but both of them believe and preach that Jesus wants you to be rich and successful. This is not what the people that I'm talking about do. So just to get them off the screen. Okay, so I want to talk about some very, the kind of techniques that the evangelical financial ministers use. And you can tell here that they really want you to save your pennies, right? So this form of Christian finance relies on a very basic accounting technique. It requires believers to develop a numerical record of their spending that they can tally against their income. So participants track their spending for 30 days at first, keeping a record of both large expenses, like rent, to even things like packs of gum, I mean things that you spend your pocket change on. And then they compare their costs to what they have coming in. And of course, more should come in than goes out, right? So this is not a, there's very little in the way of innovation in that regard. Church members also create a plan to establish an emergency fund of 2 months' salary, and budget coaches work with clients to relieve their debts by identifying high-interest loans and establishing a strategy for paying off credit cards. They encourage consistent savings and also educate clients about compound interest to achieve long-term goals like college education and home purchases. Okay, so that's pretty standard. Hopefully your mom taught you all of that. But what makes this different than what your mother probably taught you is that a set of foundational religious problems makes financial issues seem to be such a pressing ministry agenda. And evangelical Christianity is organized around a key paradox that renders financial choice a particularly acute problem. Marked by literal readings of the Bible and constant reference to Scripture, evangelicals practice a conservative theology that draws a bright line. On one side stands the realm of believers, or the kingdom, where God's word defines the rules of social life and personal conduct. On the other lies the world, where ungodly values threaten to corrupt believers trying to follow Jesus' example and scriptural strictures. Yet, evangelicals maintain work, school, neighborhood, and media lives that draw them into contact with these worldly values every day. In other words, they're not the kind of fundamentalists that retreat from the world. They have to, in fact, be in the world. And probably the foundational theological imperative of evangelicals kind of deepens the exchange across the divide, and that is converting souls. And doing this conversion, or trying to gain conversions, begets a practical necessity to reach out to those who have not yet been saved and to bring them to church, into the church. The sociologist Christian Smith calls this an engaged orthodoxy, and it requires believers to relate to the world outside of the church. So there cannot be any kind of retreat. The distinction between kingdom and world, though, renders a really difficult problem for financial ministry. And it's that believers cast their domain of economic choices as a key element of this world apart, yet their Christian duties require them to engage in that world. So they act as actually really good moderns, which is that they say religion is here and economics is here, but that doesn't work for the kind of evangelical theology that these churches are preaching. Financial ministers understand this improper ascription of the division as the distinctive source of Christians' economic challenges. Engagement with the world, then, or this is my argument, that engagement with the world, and particularly its social and material environment, hooks believers into circuits of spending by invidious comparison and material dependence. No decision in financial ministry can be made autonomously, though, or under the guidance of financial ministry. Ministers instead exhort their clients and audiences to become God's money managers, releasing their false ideas of solo economic choice. Believers should, instead, recognize God's ownership of their household possessions, Jesus' companionship in their economic decisions, and seek out other believers to advise them in their financial habits and choices. So I see that these two different spheres that the evangelicals identify, the world and the kingdom, is actually operating as two different kinds of circuits. So the circuit, the first circuit that I'll describe is the world circuit. The world is configured as channeling influence through social comparison and owning things. Financial ministry fingers a sense of social insecurity for driving unwise spending, which is, of course, a common way of describing consumer behavior. But things, too, are compelling. In suburban America, of course, cars, homes, clothes, and entertainment all produce dependence through material reward. And Americans stay hooked on these demands, hooked on these things through the demands the things themselves place on their attention and on their time, which they then devote in the service to the stuff. Caring for the objects too requires physical upkeep and payments that stretch far into the future, enjoining believers to pursue secular success at work and to commit their incomes to banks that encourage and administer their debts. I see both location and a specific sociality between objects and people defining this circuit. But first, location defines the specific conflicts between the world and God's kingdom. The Bay Area's prosperity provides distinct inputs that foster comparison. So, as I mentioned, Abundant Life happens to share a town with Google in the heart of Silicon Valley. So there's quite a lot of money there. And many of the members and many of the people that I interviewed for the project work in the really well-paid reaches of high tech. So unlike the kind of evangelical audience that you might be familiar with from, say, Susan Harding's work, these are actually quite prosperous people. But the potential for upward comparison reaches really stratospheric heights in the Bay Area, with ultra-wealthy enclaves like towns like Atherton and Woodside, where the homes go from a few million to many, many millions of dollars are located. So in the privatized and widely dispersed spaces of Northern California, cars in particular form an important kind of locus of discussion and also an important private public face. Riding along highways, suburbanites encounter the neighbors with whom they have few exchanges. So cars mark both financial divisions and express economic success. Across all of the interviews and sermons and also the Christian financial media that I examine, cars emerge as flashpoints for the environment of social comparison that defines the worldly circuit. So Dave, who happens to be a financial industry executive and also a minister at the church, described the effect of wealth in cars on both himself and his budget counselees. He said, living in the Bay Area, there's so many millionaires, and seeing all of them drive around in fancy cars and hearing about them constantly in the news and knowing they're just down the street from you makes people feel like they've got to spend more. I know the pressure of seeing all these millionaires around, all these designer cars. There's an uneasiness about your situation if you don't have these material things. And Karen, who herself is a former tour guide and a teacher, an English teacher in Sunnyvale, kind of on the other end of the economic spectrum, described the feeling this way. She said, it's just the environment influences me. And we know the environment influences everybody to spending, but it's just how insidious some of these things are. And one of the things that really was kind of a difficult image sort of thing was my car. I haven't had to have a very expensive car most of the time, but you can kind of get a feeling when you have a nicer car than you do when you don't have a nicer car. So cars can also signal the difference between worldly and godly modes of spending. Lester, who's a key organizer of the Abundant Life Ministry, expressed attention to me this way. He said, this is such an affluent area, and I think affluence is a killer to the gospel, because people who have too much tend to feel self-sufficient. That rich guy on the hill, the guy who's got 10 cars and millions of dollars, they may think they don't need God. So in this depiction, the autonomous rational actor is spiritually lost, even, or perhaps especially, if they are living in the black. Profits and acquisitions are signs of ungodly influence, not of appropriate aspiration or election. It's also a sign of belief in the value of autonomy and rationality, markers of the self-governing subject. Evangelical financial ethics turn this on its head to emphasize dependence. Believers must give up control to gain control over their finances. Attention is another critical component of the worldly circuit. Attention directs which calculations are included and overlooked in financial decisions, marking, in fact, the boundary between kingdom and the world as a direct focus to distinct modes of valuation. And it's important to remember here that the kingdom and the world exist in the same physical space, so it's a set of valuations that makes the difference between kingdom and the world, and what you pay attention to is critical in switching between these spheres. Debt, in fact, is the best example of this. So as church members acquire things, like most Americans, they also acquire debt, and debt creates a particular problem for believers. Lester, again, the ALCF organizer, put it this way, money shouldn't be a shackle around your legs. When you're in debt, you're in servitude to your spending habits. And I think it's important here to know that he's saying you're in servitude to your habits and not, which is different than the kind of debt slavery that Christian, that scriptural edict evokes when it says the borrower is servant to the lender. It's actually not the lender that's enslaving you, it's your habits. So the worldly circuit of influence produces debt, and simultaneously debt strengthens the worldly circuit of influence. It's a self-reinforcing feedback loop that they're describing. In particular, debt expands the conduit for the messages of Visa, MasterCard, and mortgage-holding banks, and demands secular work to service its needs. Focusing on repaying and the anxiety of red ink distract believers from hearing God and from contributing financially to creating a more Jesus-centered world. Money servicing loans cannot be committed to the godly circuit. Caring for stuff also has the same effect by directing attention to the stuff that you have and the process of upkeep and the process of payment. So it's not only debt, but actually the kind of maintenance function that caring for stuff imposes on the owner that is a problem as well. Okay. One thing I want to mention about the attention problem too is that it actually has an effect in the way that they figure it on the ability to actually hear God. So one of the hallmarks of this kind of very personal Christianity is that Jesus goes along with you wherever you are, right? So Jesus is on your walk with you, which means that he's by your every step. And also that you might be able to hear the Holy Spirit at any moment. And that attention distraction that both debt and caring for stuff apply to the believers actually gets in the way. It creates a kind of noise between the line between the believer and the Holy Spirit. So it actually stops It renders another division between the kingdom and the world by segregating communion with the Holy Spirit to the non-economic sphere. So if you can't, you can't hear it when you have all this attention to stuff. Okay. So now the godly circuit. Ministry language clearly identifies the circuit of material influence and social comparison, and even echoes liberal discourses of freedom when enjoining believers to break out of the destructive loop. However, the language of freedom that these ministries use subverts autonomy. Instead, the practices of financial ministry offer another set of dependencies. The second circuit of financial ministry replaces worldly with godly influence, suturing believers into the practices of evangelical relationality. There are three elements that I wanted to focus on here. The first is stewardship, fellowship, and then perhaps, of course, paradoxically for Protestant Christianity, the links between material environment and God's word that many of the publishers have been working on. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so the techniques of biblical financial reason start with giving away ownership of household finances. So this is a document from the first session of the Crown Financial Ministries curriculum that the ALCF Bible study class uses. And so the first chapter ends with these quick claim deeds. And I don't know if it's kind of big enough to read, but it says, okay, we hereby transfer to the Lord the ownership of the following possessions. And then it has a whole list of things which sound both aspirational and anachronistic. Home, John's car, Jane's car, boat, rental property, stamp collection. I'm sure all of you have stamp collections. antique piano, IBM stock. Anyway, it's a bit of an old style aspirational list, but that's the kind of idea of the sort of household that they're speaking to. And then, just in case you were concerned, it says this instrument is not a binding legal document and cannot be used to transfer property. So, just in case. Okay, so obviously this model offers a window into some kind of imagined audience for the program, but on the second, the opposite page, there's one of these quick claim deeds that the Bible study folks are supposed to fill in themselves, and when they fill it in, they can sign it, and signing the assumption that the signatory assumes the position of God's money manager. And Dan, the financial industry executive, put it this way. He said, or the intent this way, they're God's resources, we're just managers of it. And if you can take that principle, you can realize, okay, let's look at these resources and get the best return for them. You've got to get people thinking about that. Okay, this isn't mine. If you get $1,000, your paycheck, or whatever, you know it's not going to buy an HDTV. That's not necessarily what a good steward would do. What's the best return? Is it simply giving it all away? Is it simply providing for my family? What is going to be the best use of those resources? So here, relinquishing ownership places the decisions under a biblical calculus. Rather than individual desires and self-direction, the money manager position is designed to help believers use faith to recalculate decisions. Fellowship is the second critical element of the circuit. And fellowship instructs that godly, or the kind of concept of fellowship in the financial ministries, instructs that godly counsel is critical to sustaining biblical values in budgeting priorities. In addition to relinquishing ownership, the ministries instruct believers to surrender their autonomy to accountability partners, and also weekly Bible study classes and budget coaching. So that there's a kind of circuit of social relations that the ministers want you to insert yourself into in order to start making the proper calculations. Howard Dayton, who's a key figure in the financial and ministry movement, offers godly counsel as the critical component for detaching from the worldly circuit. So for making the switch to circuit A, from circuit A to circuit B. He says, from time to time, we all get hooked on something we think we must buy. A car, home, camera, boat, you name it. Once hooked, it's easy to rationalize a purchase. Please remember to seek the Lord's guidance and the counsel of a godly person when confronted with a spending decision. Budget coaching, in particular, offers fellowship as a path to such calculations, so the kind of one-on-one experience between a budget coach and the person that they're working with. The budget coaches also develop fellowship techniques. Each one of them has their kind of own approach to fellowship, to prepare participants to reshape their financial conduct. Imparting scripturally based economic reason requires a specific kind of Christian approach, and oftentimes the concept of heart is at the center of this, as a prelude, in fact, to calculation. The affective engagement of the budget counselor provides entry then into the circuit of godly influence. For instance, during their first meetings with new clients, a pair of budget coaches who work together, they're married, and receive referrals from local Christian radio, they always stayed away from any talk of money at all during their first meetings with their counselees. They keep their budgeting forms in a drawer for the first session. Instead, the initial meeting offers getting to know you time. Mrs. Sorensen prefers to just love them first, as Jesus recommends that they do. This is probably not what you'd expect from your accountant, particularly if you're paying them by the hour. But as a professional accountant, Lester, the organizer, is in a particularly good position to provide a map of the differences between secular and Christian financial guidance. So he's comparing here. He says, probably the first thing an accountant would do is to say, we need to get a financial statement on you and find out what the problem is, and probably say, well, you've got all this outstanding debt, let's consolidate it. Let's do mechanical things. And then you say, you're going to have to stop using your credit cards like you are. You're using way too much credit here. And to try to get them on a firm footing. But as a biblical financial coach, Lester uses different techniques to advance his counsel. The people need to know that I care about them. They're not interested in talking to a guy that's got a handle on numbers and manipulating numbers. That's not the kind of person they're looking for. I think they're looking for someone who has compassion, who cares about them truly, not as a job, but as a person. Approaching clients through fellowship achieves an intimate relationship. Actually, I wouldn't even call them clients, so, fellow believers. But that fellowship that achieves an intimate relationship where inputs of financial calculation are directed through a godly circuit. The third element of the circuit that I want to emphasize is making biblical values material, using the materiality of words to draw believers into the godly circuit of dependence. Financial ministry materials themselves offer opportunities to draw connections with biblical lessons. The workbook exercises that I alluded to at the beginning of the talk and prayer both encourage financial ministry audiences to render biblical values present through their hands and voices, drawing them into the believer's time and place through the body. These are just the covers of a couple of the different workbooks. This guy is very excited about his balanced budget. Recorded sermons, as I mentioned, with celebrity pastors open each session of the financial Bible study groups. But these images don't stay inside the screen. Instead, the pastors exhort their audience to actually to attend to the workbooks that are open in front of them. So the idea is that the DVD on the screen and the workbooks are work together as a pair. So just like grade school workbooks, the reader confronts sentences that are interrupted by blanks. Whatever workbook you have in second grade is what you should imagine here. Following the pastor's directions, the audience dutifully fills in words to complete the message. So it will say something like, the debtor is servant to the right? And you say you're a lender, right? And other more complicated messages as well that it requires you to write in the word that they speak. These motions realize biblical lessons through the believer's hand, inscribing the word on the page and also through the body of the believer. The workbook is effective is also in another way in that it imitates the structure of childhood lessons like your second grade workbook. And in that, returns the audience to a moment of receiving messages in the absence of adult habits and fixed values. The workbook then is designed also to elicit a state of receptiveness and then channel financial thinking through God's word and pastoral counsel through this kind of renewed space. Workbooks ask believers to literally embody the word by inscribing godly values over their worldly ones. Prayer also renders godly values material, bringing words into the believer's time and space in speech and clasped hands. So in financial Bible study sessions, believers testify about the struggles and triumphs of putting faith in God's money rules. Testimony and counsel add another layer of materiality by rendering scriptural direction and financial ministry messages in local contemporary terms. And what I mean by this is that people will testify to how how God inspired some sort of financial activity that they have done, that they that they prayed, that they were given direction to stay on their budget to achieve their goals or to help a relative, but only within the terms that God has offered them to support their own the necessities of their own lives. And so they will tell in very explicit detail what the particular situation that they're facing is, and by describing those localized problems, bring the messages of financial ministry into very, very localized contexts. Okay. Financial ministry participants also spoke frequently about how prayer brought biblical values into the immediate context of their own lives, assisting with efforts in self-control by accessing God's presence, and more importantly, into the specific situation confronting the financial challenges of living in suburban America with middle-class desires. And this is again is about the fact that in evangelical Christianity, Jesus is always kind of with you. one of the financial ministers who was a former counselee described it this way. He says, "I feel that the temptation is not driving me to do something. Before, I would always ask myself, do I really need that? And now I've changed the talk to, God, do I really need this? And then if I really need that, and I feel like God is saying, oh well, I can buy that, and then I'll pray that God can find a better deal." another financial ministry person put it this way. She said, as she was describing the situation, "It was at Macy's, and they were having a shoe sale. And I was looking for something in particular which they didn't have. And I kept looking, and I found a pair of shoes, and I tried them on. And the whole time, I was like, and I'm sure it was the Holy Spirit, you don't need those shoes. You're just going to feel guilty. And I tried them on, and finally, I did say, I can't buy them." Okay, so by way of conclusion, financial ministry identifies a troubling problem that is one's spiritual and deeply practical, and the persistent divide between the world and the kingdom and beneath believers' economic lives. The partition raises a question of conduct. How should believers escape improper influence within the worldly environment? To achieve rationality, believers must integrate into the godly circuit of dependence while continuing to live in the ungodly world. Rational budgeting requires, in this understanding, recognition of the worldly circuit's influence, but it does not offer the autonomy that we might expect. Rather, it replaces it. Financial ministries offer techniques that turn economic autonomy inside out. They imbue financial decisions with God's will and promote an idea of the physical environment which renders independent choice impossible. Instead, faith can release believers from the dangers of autonomous thinking, of pursuing their interests independently of God's purpose. To achieve freedom, the freedom that a market economy offers, then, conservative Christians must submit to God's will. Giving up autonomy and calculating under godly influence then provides a base for the successful, rational, economic action that we would expect from a very different kind of actor. And it allows believers to make decisions that will allow them to live in the black in a Jesus-centered way, and to guide their by guiding their spending in line with their income. Financial ministry turns liberal understandings of rationality inside out, even as it produces rationality as an effect of the prescribed practices. So I'm just going to summarize some of these inversions. The first one that seems very strange in terms of kind of liberal thinking about rationality is that ownership promotes irrationality, where the liberal notion is that, of course, interests promote their own rational pursuit. Instead, a financial ministry channeling the will of another, God, in this case, promotes proper calculation. The second, that rationality depends upon the environment and cannot operate actually independently from it. Physical objects and social imperatives shape preferences and desires and choices. Preferences express the pull of the environment rather than self-directed wishes or individual tastes. Things, financial possibilities, and social pressures all sway choice. And third, social engagement enables self-correction. Under environmental influence, people actually don't have the ability to correct themselves. Fellowship and the social circuits of kingdom thinking are necessary to support adherence to the spending goal. So the particular relationality of evangelical Christianity is the undergirding support for budgeting. So for believers, in the end, calculating their interests begins with renouncing both the possibility and the desirability of autonomy. All right, so let me suggest another site. And this one is much closer to home in terms of academic thinking, at least, where this renegotiation around rationality is taking place, and that's in behavioral economics and the policy agenda that it is currently supporting. So this book was a longtime bestseller, Nudge: Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, by Richard Thaler, a very prominent behavioral economist, actually one of the founders of the field of behavioral economics at the University of Chicago, and Cass Sunstein, who was a professor of law and a specialist in law and economics, who happens now to be high up in the Obama administration. In the book, these two argue for choice architecture, that's their term, and it's a policy orientation, a policy responsibility for organizing the context in which people make decisions. Both financial ministries and these libertarian paternalists, that's their term for themselves, it's intentionally paradoxical, address the same set of problems, living with both the necessity and inability to plan for long-term well-being under market conditions. Like their Christian counterparts, their analysis and argument is forged around the fallibility of human calculation. For instance, they open the book with the example of a cafeteria line. It has been documented by behavioral economists that apparently we all buy whatever is next to the cash register. and the location of food items in the environment influences people's choices. So if you place potato chips next to the cash register, people will buy them. If you place carrots next to the cash register, people will buy those. So obviously choice architects like Thaler and Sunstein would like for experts to identify places that could be shaped in order to direct the choices, the otherwise free choices of people moving through these consumer environments. they call this nudging. That's where the nudge comes from. And of course, this is based in a firmly secular liberal understanding of freedom. But each of these, what each of these sites do, the behavioral economy literature and the financial ministries, is to shift the location of rationality. Evangelicals shift rationality to the influence of the godly circuit, and behavioral economists shift rationality to the influence of experts. But for both, the importance of the environment is central. Evangelicals place emphasis on changing the value derived from environmental inputs by finding its godly meaning. And behavioral economists, for behavioral economists, environments are information frames that interact with human psychological processes. As an unlikely pair, both financial ministers and behavioral economists turn the idea of autonomous action inside out and focus instead on the limitations of self-government, the Christians naming it actually undesirable as well. Each group then devises strategies that use dependence on the environment and on others to reproduce rational action as an effect. Each is contributing to a reflexive rationality, producing analysis of human failures to adapt to our contemporary economic system, and using that knowledge to create, to generate the kinds of rational decisions that are supposed to create its structure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much,
Caitlin, for that wonderful talk. And we'll now take some questions from the audience. We've got quite a lot of time in which to do that, so I hope there'll be lots of discussion. Andrew?
Thank you for your paper. I enjoyed it very much. I wondered if there was a slightly broader stroke analysis to be done here. Because what I was thinking was that this very particular kind of set of three dispositions and characteristics that you outlined, and you said that they also are sort of somewhat replicated in behavioural economics. I was thinking actually the broader picture to be told here is of how popular American society deals with the issue of vice. So what I was thinking was there was a very notable parallel when you were talking about how we're supposed to deal with, in evangelical terms, reckless spending, with how from the 1950s lots of popular movements said we should deal with things like gambling addictions, with alcoholism and drug addiction. Because the three things you described, they're also very strongly replicated in emphasis on things like being part of a fellowship, on submitting to a higher power, and also explicitly on environmental inputs. So, you know, the discourse there is on the company you keep. So I wonder if actually this is coming from something broader, which is how Americans deal with dealing with vice.
Well, it's not how Americans deal with dealing with vice. It's how evangelical Christianity has used vice or unwise decisions to engage people in faith. Because what you're describing, Alcoholics Anonymous or Debtors Anonymous, all of the anonymouses, have an evangelical root. They share a root. That's why it sounds the same. It's not that the financial ministries are necessarily outgrowths of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that in fact Alcoholics Anonymous and these financial ministries both draw on very similar tenets of faith. And that they also are part of a kind of popular self-help, they're continuous with a popular self-help kind of rhetoric that also has evangelical roots. So something like Alcoholics or Debtors Anonymous operates in a secular field. You don't have to be a Christian or you don't have to access it through a church, but it is. But the genetic roots of it are actually the same. So it, and you know, that's not all. So it's not all Americans and our vices.
Thanks for the question. How do you think this would have been different if you'd done this in like the southern part of the United States? So like your context is in California. So like I know that there's huge
So Crown Financial Ministries, which is the, it's hard to say what exactly it is. Business is not exactly it, but the organization that develops the materials for many, many financial ministry programs across the country, tens of thousands of them, is in Georgia. Okay. So the issue isn't so much regional as it is brand of evangelicalism, and the kinds of churches that I was describing, that Rick Warren, who's in Southern rather than Northern California, which might not sound that important here, but it's critically important he is very involved in this. Obviously, these churches in Northern California, there's a big one that develops its own materials in Illinois. It's all over the South. It's about the brand of evangelical Christianity, which is not a hellfire and brimstone brand at all. These are people that are not speaking in tongues. They don't like hell. They don't talk about hell. Sometimes they talk about the devil, but that's kind of different. So it's about a middle class brand of Christianity that appeals to people who are either middle class or aspiring to be middle class, and trying to help them organize their economic lives, because it is really very much connected to their current or aspiring economic position.
Thanks. I'm interested in how this relates to the broader sort of debt advice phenomenon. And do you have any idea when these people started talking about this? Because it's so extraordinarily widespread. South Africa, it's everywhere. Pastor Jerome Liberty, the website's all about how to not spend your money and things. But given that it's a sort of widespread phenomenon, in secular areas as well. Mm-hmm. I just wondered, where do you fit this in relation to that?
That's a really good question. And actually, in my broader project, I bring these experts together with other kind of more formal experts. There's and the entire field of expertise all begins at essentially the same time in the United States, which is in the late 1970s. Which shouldn't be a surprise, as this is the moment where the American economy begins to deindustrialize and lots of people start to have to, in fact, do a much more kind of careful management if they want to perhaps continue or maybe aspire to middle class status. So it starts in the late 1970s, and it starts in the church field, it starts in the secular field. And personal finance journalism also begins at that point. So this kind of variety of service journalism that we now kind of take for granted, that there'll be like a Your Money column in the paper. And all of these are addressing the similar problems that many, many Americans are facing in different idioms of expertise. So the certified financial planner, people who are often also terms accountants or other kinds of professionals like that, do a much more sort of standard job of what Lester described in my talk of trying to balance your accounts. They're not trying to undergird you with some other form of source of your own. Of your own rationality.
Stephanie? I'm puzzled by the parallel you've drawn with Nudge, because it all centers around the issue of choice and freedom, choice architecture in their case, and the dependent freedom of prayer, of being in touch with the Holy Spirit. And from your point of view, as an analyst, do you not think that Nudge doesn't allow freedom at all? It's an architecture of choice. Whereas freedom through prayer actually is mobilizing the entire subject much better, much more consciously, and therefore much more freely than President Obama's advice does.
So I think that they both use the language of freedom, right? And one interesting element of American politics is that oftentimes words have double meanings to appeal to an evangelical and non-evangelical audience, which is something that I've only come to learn through this project. There are certain buzzwords that mean perhaps the opposite of what they mean to people outside of the church. Freedom is one of those words, right? So, as an analyst, what I'm saying is that the prayer develops relationality in the service of promoting what looks like rational decision making. But they wouldn't say it promotes relationality. They wouldn't put that word on, but they would say that it's your individual relationship to God that what is engaged by prayer. But what I'm saying is that may be very much true for the people who are doing the praying, but what I see it doing is actually establishing relations not only with God, but with other Christians, with the environment, so that the prayer actually does the kind of opposite of what we think of as freedom for the autonomous liberal subject, which is the ability to enact choice according to what are internal preferences that are developed outside of the context with others.
Craig?
Yeah, I'm
Hi.
You opened with a gender comment on that traditional liberal subject as a male head of household, but then the rest of the talk didn't really thematize gender.
Yeah.
I wonder if you'd say a little more about that and how that plays out in these evangelical settings.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, especially because evangelical Christianity has a very, very traditionalist idea of how gender roles are supposed to play out in the household. So, here, I'll just go. This is my stand-in for some sort of vision of this. But we have John's car, Jane's car. You know, there's also a kind of traditional American version of this traditional Christian household that this is all taking part in. So it is very much wrapped up in that. In terms of its appeal to evangelical Christian values, which still ask the wife to be completely subservient to the husband. I mean, and so there's just a weird disconnect about this, because they'll be talking about this, and then there are women who are single heads of households, there are single mothers, there are lots of different configurations of family that are more frequently than not at complete odds with this traditional gender version of the family that this kind of financial advice would presumably enable. Right? You're trying to enable financially healthy households by doing this, but the truth of the matter is that most of the households don't look like that. You know. There's a great flexibility in this kind of rhetoric, because it is also so individualizing. So, you know, as an analyst, what I'm saying is that this develops relations in all of these different directions. But in the structure of the advice that they're giving, the advice is all about the individual, and that's part of also what is similar to the kind of self-help rhetoric of the self-help movement and Alcoholics Anonymous and things like that. That evangelical relation to God is so personal and so individual, means that you can kind of disconnect it from that heavily gendered and kind of anachronistic version of the household. So people find it useful, even though it also comes with this very patriarchal vision of how households are supposed to work.
My comment was based on that of the previous gentleman, the relationship between the evangelicals and Nudge. But it's slightly different. So it's not just the behavioral economists who have been discussing how people make decisions. Also, sociologists who look at financial markets, or anthropologists, including yourself, have been looking at this, been looking at patterns of calculation in a trading bit. So I'm wondering whether, you know, how you come at this. Is it that you agree with behavioral economics and you are in a way claiming that what the evangelists are doing is not quite the same or not quite right? Or is it that you disagree with what they do and maybe that the evangelicals are doing better? What's your own position as somebody who's in a field very, very nearby vis-a-vis that?
Sure. My position is that these are two sites that, that hold together what are both traditional visions of kind of liberal autonomous economic subjects and also seem to be appealing to exactly the opposite. Whereas anthropology and sociology, we didn't ever think that people worked that way, right? So, I mean, you know, back to Malinowski, at least. So what I'm interested in isn't so much whether or not I agree or disagree with them. I think choice architecture is fine. I'm good with experts. I mean, it doesn't bother me that you know we're going to place potato chips at the front of the back of the line, or if your 401k is opt in or opt out. I think you know opting and having it be, which is one of the big policy victories of this movement, that having your individual savings account be opt out rather than opt in at the point of signing your contract with your company is a good idea, right? But why I'm interested in these things together is that there are places that are both committed to producing the effects of rationality, right? Which is not really what anthropologists or sociologists are interested in, that they want these effects of rationality, but they're doing it by revising the kinds of they're getting the effects of rationality by first assessing the failures of that rationality and then revising it.
I really appreciate the tension between living in the world circuit and the kingdom circuit your chaps face. But there's two things that I'm unclear about. One is that, what is the kind of ideological underpinnings to how they think about money beyond the question of not going into debt? Is it that we're supposed to lead a life which is about austerity and actually owning as few things as possible, or giving up all those things to a community which will then look after you? Or is there, it seems to me that beyond debt, beyond not going into debt, actually the world kingdom and the world circuit and the kingdom circuit are actually not that different. So I was wondering whether you could kind of pull out the differences a bit more. And thinking about that, I was wondering whether actually the crucial distinction is not between the world circuit and the kingdom circuit, but the fact that finance is being separated from other aspects of life. So ownership promotes irrationality when it comes to finance, but when it comes to women, it's completely irrational to own women. So actually the problem is actually that finance is being dealt with separately to things like class distinctions or gender distinctions, etc. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the real kind of tension as opposed to that between the world circuit and the kingdom circuit. Mm-hmm.
Well, just on the woman question, it's not okay to own women. They don't own women. They're although the man may be a steward of his household, right? Which is precisely that they don't own their wife. Right? They are stewards of the family, right? Which is a kind of metaphor that goes all the way up to the stewardship of government. It's something that can be it's kind of a metaphor that can scale up very quickly. So you may be the steward of your pocketbook, but you're also also the steward of your household and of your country. But one of the ideological underpinnings is not that you're supposed to live a life of austerity, as you know, this kind of points out, right? You have furniture, you have rental property. That's not austerity. But the idea is actually, I think, a quite interesting one, because it isn't saying that all consumption is bad, right? It's saying that actually you take care of your family in a standard that comports with some kind of middle class life, and that includes owning a house, that includes sending them to college, that includes plenty of material things. But one of the elements that these ministries encourage is to actually take on a spending cap. Right? Once you've gotten enough, right, or whatever, by however you work that out with your pastor, your God, that you stop spending, right, and then you start giving money to God in other ways. But so the idea is that the money should be used for godly purposes, which the church members are directed to find in the literal word of the Bible, and they will tell you that there are 2,350 passages in the Bible that have references to money or finance. Part of I think what's interesting is that the actual acquisition of stuff ends up being not necessarily a marker of any kind of election in this particular ideology, if you want. It's that it's in fact that at some point the acquisition of stuff is a signal of being kind of in the wrong, in producing the wrong calculations by not evaluating things correctly.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. I have a lot of questions for you, but I won't ask them all. But ask a very simple one and then a few other maybe rambling ones. One, do they tithe? Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to push you on the kingdom stuff here. Can you say a bit more about what kind of kingdom theology they actually have? Because I think that could reflect very productively on their notions of agency and their relationship with the Lord, which is, mm-hmm. as you put it, in this very kind of personal friend model, a very particular kind of intimacy that Tanya Lerman has talked about, John Bielski and others. But is this a kind of can signs of the kingdom, first of all, be certainly recognized by the average member of the church? And are those signs of the kingdom already there? Are they kind of inbreakings of what the future world, the world to come, these kind of already not yet signs of the kingdom? Mm-hmm. Or are they the kind of signs of the kingdom which can actually be ushered in through the actions of Christians? Mm-hmm. So I think that could tell us a lot about the notions of agency. And so on the question of agency, I talked a lot about nudge, and there have been some questions about nudge, but I want to invoke another kind of New Yorker-ish type book, quite literally, Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point, which in an earlier, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, was the big book. And of course, what's so interesting in the difference between nudge and the tipping point is that in the tipping point is about contingencies and the inability really to know when hush puppies are really going to become the hot shoes to wear. Right. And of course, all of these people read Malcolm Gladwell's book, marketers, educators, trying to find out how they could find the tipping point. And I think what's interesting to me about the tipping point in relation to this evangelical Christianity is that of all the people who are interested in Gladwell's book, the people who we might have most expected to be interested in would be
evangelical Christian is born again, because the whole idea of a certain kind of Pauline conversion is this tipping point, this kind of sudden moment when everything changes, right? And that's very different from this kind of nudgy moment, right? The whole point of nudge being, if you tell people to do stuff too strongly, they don't like that, right? Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can maybe tease out a bit of the things that you're saying about agency with their particular ideas of becoming born again or finding that relationship with Jesus, which is so important to them. How do they tie that kind of moment of conversion to a model of agency and contingency?
That is a very big set of questions. So let me take the tithe one first, because that's simple. They want people to tithe. They want it 10%. They want it before tax. So the major idea of getting money to God is that people have to, in fact, have the money in order to give it to God. And so tithing can be done in many different ways. So it isn't simply that they encourage people to tithe by giving money directly to the church where they go to services. I mean, of course, these services are enormous. They are big productions. They are enormously expensive. They want people to support the churches where they go to services and whose ministries they use and all that kind of thing. So they want people to tithe, and it's that's definitely part of the idea, but they could tithe by giving to their particular church, but they could tithe to giving to other sorts of godly endeavors as well. So it's not a kind of Falwell-esque sending your money situation. That's not how they think about giving money to God. The question of kingdom theology is really interesting. It's definitely something that I need to work in more here. It's definitely that the kingdom can be ushered in by the action of Christians. That is part of that is very much part of the theology that they work with, kind of often in a very implicit way. So it isn't that they are always that they can kind of usher in a literal kingdom, but rather it's this kind of emergent quality of the kingdom that is part of why I was interested in the metaphor of the circuit. So you can kind of bring it into being as you move through the world, not necessarily all at once altogether, but you can bring it in as you move through space, and that's part of Christians bringing the kingdom into the world. So I hope works with the idea of the circuit. The circuit remains this kind of internal sort of cybernetic metaphor, whereas the kingdom is a much more kind of one that's external and part of bringing God into the godless world. I hadn't thought about the tipping point, but that's a really interesting juxtaposition. it does occur to me that the tipping point phenomenon also works very much with the kind of what you might call the vast media strategy of evangelical Christianity, which takes both more secular and more explicitly religious forms. So on the one hand, there's lots of self-help literature out there which has very evangelical messages embedded in it, but which is kind of quietly subversive about a spiritual and individual and powerful spiritual relation to God. AA being probably the best known of them. And of course, there's a huge it's always kind of surprising for people who don't have this orientation themselves, but in the United States, there is a parallel Christian media sphere, and it is enormous, and it has many different varieties. And so part of the production of agency of bringing the kingdom into the world is through this kind of partially a dual media strategy of which the financial ministries are a part, and which AA are a part, and which I think probably connect up with the idea of getting conversions to a kind of tipping point, not by necessarily just the actions of individuals, but as a kind of creation of an environment within an environment that will then tip the world over to God.
I thought it was fascinating, especially this deed and how much it is a capitalist creed, and it takes away like all the possibility or potential that was in Christianity, kind of to be against capitalism and to be critical of it, because this is actually believing in capitalism. And I was wondering if that's irrational. I mean, you said that the evangelical rationality is that ownership produces irrationality, but in here, the Lord surely is not irrational once the Lord owns the stuff. My question is really, isn't the evangelical rationality you describe just the this world rationality? Because the kingdom rationality is capitalist rationality. And is just a liberal individualist rationality.
Well, I think what you're pointing to is the continued tension between this kind of liberal autonomous, perfectly continuous with capitalism subject and the kind of kingdom rationality. Of course, God is not doesn't get sucked up into worldly circuits of evaluation once he gets handed this stuff. But the point is that God is never in a conflict between worldly values and his own, right? God purpose of the financial ministries is to confront this particular problem, which is that there's a tension in the world between these worldly economic values and the kingdom ones. So the rationality is certainly continuous with capitalist rationality, but I'm not trying to say it's anything different than continuous with capitalist rationality, although it has limitations. Right? But what I'm saying is that there are these sites, and this is one of them, that produce the effects of capitalist rationality without, in fact, or by changing the conditions under which that might happen. And so, in some ways, this is a very kind of straight-ahead rethinking of Weber, right? So it wasn't then that Calvinists were somehow seizing the potential, the radical potential of Christianity to overthrow capitalism. That obviously Weber's argument is that in fact the distance between the believer and God was the kind of producer of the impulse to make these accounts work. I believe it's completely continuous with capitalist rationality.
Can I just take the privilege of asking you a question that relates to that question, which is, I wonder if you can unpick for us what the name of the church is, Abundant Life, right? And you said very little about that. Your presentation was about the creation of this rational individual self, which fits into this Weberian and kind of political and behavioral economist model. But actually, what is this symbolism of abundant life? Mm-hmm. And how does it work? How does it move through the kingdom of God, the circuit of God, and the kingdom of the circuit of the world in a way that it would, say, in popular Hinduism? Or is it something else that is beyond that sort of guarantees these deeds and beyond these circuits, which then makes it possible to engage in them without actually these worldly states without actually becoming polluted by them. You know, what is this abundant life?
Mm-hmm.
And is it, you know, how is it similar or different to, you know, Arendt's take on Marx's idea of life, that his idea of life that circulates in labour is actually a Protestant idea, kind of then turned into a materialist idea. So I think it would be, you know, very interesting at this point to explain.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure about the second. That might be a conversation for later. But yes. So it is interesting that the church is called Abundant Life, and honestly, that was definitely not at the forefront of my analysis. But it certainly raises a good question. And you know, I mean, the very fact that they name the church Abundant Life has this dual resonance embedded within it, because abundance, of course, is probably the only religion in the United States that is bigger than evangelical Christianity. So that appeal to abundance, to what can be considered a kind of material satisfaction, is certainly in the name. But you know, they want to play the two registers against each other, because the abundant life, you know, that the pastor will tell you that he's going for is an abundance that's only available, of course, under the in the relationship itself with Jesus Christ. And the abundance that relationship is the abundance, and then everything else
stems from that, but that's a tangent that they definitely want to play. So, I just want to come in there because I have a question really, but I'm framed in terms of this abundant life and the language of credit that you didn't draw on. If we think of debt as a form of credit, you're sketching a real deficit, you know, I'm not very good on you, but you're sketching a deficit model. Where I'm unclear as to what are the mechanisms of transformation from either spiritual or material debt into abundant life. And I just wonder if there aren't some non-financial ideas of debt that are being presented as though they were financial, but they're going on quite different and beyond economic. I think that's what Laura was also saying. Quite non-economic realms of life. I mean, if you think of biblical imagery of debt and credit.
You can imagine
that much of what you've shown us about debt could be about the non-financial, without it needing to be seen as an effect of rationality and repackaging and so on. So I suppose simply the question is, how do you convert in this system debt in the sense you described to us into a credit model of abundant life?
So there are debts in Christianity. The big one being to Jesus, who died on the cross, right? That are central to the theology, and not in any way reducible to a financial calculation at all. That Jesus gave his life, right? Is the ultimate abundant credit model, I think.
Well, it's supporting a deficit model as well, isn't it?
That's how it works, doesn't it? If you have a credit, you have a debt. If you have a debt, you have a credit. There's a sort of conflation already around the debt language in terms of the life of Jesus Christ. I mean that is at the core of what the mechanism of abundance is. So I think that because my analytic interest is in kind of comparing these ideas of or kind of what is happening to the rational actor in this peculiar moment that we live in. That's definitely been my analytic focus. But certainly it's hard to get around, in particular because these people are so interested in this very personal relationship with Jesus and with living out that relation, which is never a cancelable debt, right? That kind of ongoing credit relation is the foundation of their relationship to God. It can't be canceled.
Thanks. I wanted to ask you two questions, and basically about opening the seal of this world a little bit. So my first question is, how do the advice given by these ministries dovetail with or diverge from other kinds of imperatives people feel upon themselves? Say, for example, the patriotic duty is spent, you know, in America, so your nationalism and religious advice. So that would be one kind. So how do these sort of concerns or conflicts speak to each other?
Mm-hmm.
The second one is a slightly different. I was wondering, what is it about this particular moment of transformation in the architecture of personal finance that prompts a caring profession of this kind to come into being? Because I was thinking of, say, early 20th century, you get the birth of home economics,
mm-hmm.
where you're actually given workbooks like this,
yeah.
to sort of learn how to manage your world in terms of money, and tutored into it. So thrift is always a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it about this particular moment that gives birth to, and appeals to a certain kind of person, middle class person in America?
Yeah. So the kind of political imperative to spend, or the idea that the American economy, which for so long basically floated both ourselves and much of the world on the backs of our credit cards, that may be coming to an end. But certainly when this was coming up, there was always a tension in that kind of imperative to spend, which was that it was being fueled by loans, right? So it had that kind of imperative to spend has the contradiction built within it. People weren't spending what they had; people were spending what they didn't have, and that is part of the origin. That's part of why this ministry and also all the other expert zones that I mentioned before, I believe, are coming up right at that moment. It's a little hard to overlook the conundrum that so many American families, particularly middle-class ones, found themselves in newly at that point. So it was, so for poor people, this was a condition that had already existed. For the middle class, this was new, and that newness meant that it was a problem that they didn't really know how to solve. Right? And so that these experts are kind of stepping in to help with that conundrum.
Is this conflict explicitly articulated in those terms, in those conversations?
So what I mean, they wouldn't focus in on the kind of political imperative to spend, not the George Bush standing on top of the World Trade Center pile with his megaphone moment, I think that they do allude to it with the focus on social comparison that is very much a part of the financial ministry rhetoric, that they understand the impulse to spend as one of being an issue of social comparison. And they do very much allude to that while trying to kind of mitigate against it because of the kind of contradiction that's embedded in both this desire to spend, this kind of constant race for more spending that this sort of invidious comparison generates, and the fact that people didn't really have the money to do it at all. But I think what you were raising when you raised the comparison of home economics was why this particular kind of caring now versus, say, a home economics kind of caring. And the rise of evangelical Christianity in the United States in this form, in this kind of corporatized office park settings, and in, I mean, which are literally, I mean, they're literally in office parks, so it's, you know, that sounds sort of derogatory, but it's just a description. But that kind of, the Christianity that feels very corporate, that appeals to a corporate worker, that is embedded in those kind of aesthetics, and which meets people at the point of their kind of affective relation to work, is also very much coming up and flourishing around this same moment in history. So those two things go I think very nicely together.
Sorry, I didn't think of that. I'm just thinking for a nice talk. My question is about time, because what you're talking about is about not spending more than you have, and another thing you can of course spend is also time. So I was just wondering if you could say a bit more about work ethics and leisure time, and because what I'm thinking is is the best way then to establish a good relation with God, or is that through work? Because with work you can earn money. Or is it by spending time with the fellowship in the church? Or because it's obviously not consuming. So just time, time.
Mm-hmm. No, it actually developing a good relationship with God does have to do with it consuming, in fact. And so, you know, but it, because you just have to consume in a way that honors God's values, right? So, consumption is actually a zone in which people can express their relationship with Jesus. Work is another one of those places that financial ministers worry is disconnected in that nicely modern way from religion. That the economic sphere, which you know is composed mostly of kind of work, you can divide it into work and leisure pursuits. That work is also a place that has these problems embedded within it. You know, and I think that one interesting kind of flipping from say the Weberian reading is that this does kind of shift the focus to consumption rather than work as the primary site of the development of a relationship with God, that's consumption. So they, in fact, the way that the financial ministries are organized, work becomes an extension of consumption rather than consumption being an extension of work. And so, you know, I mean, this is also a, I think, a product of this, of the problem that I was just alluding to, because work no longer, you know, for most Americans, no longer is actually doing what it needs to do in order to promote consumption, the kind of consumption that these sorts of Americans that either aspire to or have come to expect. So, you know, that work is kind of subservient to consumption here, I think makes a bit of historical sense.
Well, I'm
curious a bit more about the motivations. I don't know if you interviewed some of the executives that initiated or kind of oversaw this program, but their motivations, whether they kind of see American society as overly materialistic, and this is a sort of something therapeutic that they're providing to churchgoers, or whether they're trying as a goal to try to like eclipse in some sense or replace some of the tasks that accountants or financial planners of some sorts do, or whether it's more just kind of expanding their own individual churches or just ideological, those
mm-hmm.
sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. So there are several reasons for their interest in financial ministry. I mean, at the heart of it is conversion. That if you get, which is kind of ironic because they are helping no one but other Christians at this point because they don't have the manpower to use this ministry for evangelism. But the idea is that one day, I suppose when they have helped every Christian who's helped in the Bay Area, that they will use this as an evangelical tool, because of course the an evangelizing tool, because of course the narrative of evangelical conversion is really about a kind of descent and then a rebirth, right? So you get people who are in some sort of descent, whether it's an alcoholic descent or a debt descent, or in a time of crisis, and that time of crisis provides an opportunity for rebirth. So if you can kind of meet people at that moment, then so that's evangelizing is one of the kind of central reasons for doing. Governments do provide quite a bit of this kind of advice, but what they don't do is provide another rationale, right, a positive valuation to go along with the downsizing of consumption, right? And that's what the churches do. So it's not just that it sucks because you don't have a job and so you can't buy the things that you thought that you were going to be able to buy, is that in fact you are enacting a relation that is going to, in one way or another, bring you abundance. Okay? So it names the condition as being in improper evaluation rather than it being just a simple and really quite devastating for Americans transition to a lower degree of consumption.
Do they have any advice about the economy?
I'm waiting for the next follow-up line. You mean do they engage in political?
And you've described it as household finances. You haven't mentioned any advice about investment, saving where.
They don't do that.
They don't do that, exactly. So that So presumably, therefore, they've got nothing to say about the economy.
Well, I mean, they say they will give you generic ideas, but they don't tell. But what I meant when they say that they don't tell you where to put your money. I mean, they don't tell you to go to Wells Fargo versus, whatever the other corner bank is. They're not selling services. I mean, they may tell you that bonds earn compound interest. Because this is about developing in the end a personal relationship with Jesus, then they don't have a lot to say about what the kind of macro conditions that place you under whatever stress you're facing, what the origins of those macro conditions are. I mean, and that's again a kind of hallmark of the self-help genre that is much more familiar to many people, but which is very much continuous with the kind of advice form that this kind of ministry participates in. It's very, very individualizing.
So, in its
rhetoric, what I think what it does is do not that. It produces all these relations, but the the kind of idea is it is that your relationship to God is the kind of thing, not your relationship to the government.
So it's a completely different scale of failure from the failure of hedge fund managers. Which is one of the other things that you're interested in. So how are you relating the two pieces of research?
Actually, I have a question for your own performance. That's a bit of a follow-up question on Stefan's question. Is the national debt the same as household debt? Because of course what happens within austerity rhetoric, you know, in Britain and everywhere else, you know, the household debt is the national debt, and there's no distinction between them. There's no Keynesian notion of sort of abundance that is used by the state. So I wonder whether there is any sort of sign amongst your informants that they would project this onto the scale of the nation so that it could become a political project, an austerity project, or maybe not.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have the same rhetoric about the national and the household debt being a similar form in the U.S. as here, although I think we don't have quite the public discussions about austerity or the same degree of those measures at all. But of course, yeah, I mean, you know, that kind of cutting rhetoric is certainly underpinned by an idea of kind of simple household accounts. What would make this available for that kind of analogy is the fact that it is a very individualizing discourse. So it's one that sees the household as the primary unit, and in developing that kind of model of how economy is produced, it invites kind of scaling. It does invite scaling on.
Sorry,
hi, thanks for your talk. I have a lot of questions that I'm uncomfortable just connecting up to what the most recent discussion is. I found it very interesting in connecting up with some of the messages that have happened this past week with, like, you're saying this race method, something that works for Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
His letter to the New York Times and basically talked about how the culture within the financial industry has changed so much. And whereas before there was care and concern for the clients, now there's not. And it seemed to me in listening to your talk and some of the things that this church is providing is just that. You give an impersonal analysis of someone's financial conditions, but rather they actually care about the client or their in the church. And that makes me think more widely just some of the things that have been going on, whether a lot of the reasons why people would do this in the first place has to do obviously with the uncertainty of the economic situation in America and worldwide. And it seemed that there was a number of parts of what you were explaining that worked very well with that, and it comes down to, in many cases, issues of control, having a lack of control of their money or what to expect for the future, a lot of uncertainty, and the church, what it does by offering this is, for one thing, what they're doing is it gives the church a means to control people by controlling their assets vicariously. You know, they're thinking of Jesus while they're buying shoes, and they've got a fair amount of control. But at the same time, the people, by doing this, by giving up their thing of their assets to really belong to God, in some ways, it could be seen as a great relief for them. No longer are they responsible for them. No longer are they completely, it doesn't matter so much if they're not keeping up with the Joneses next door, because suddenly it's no longer their possession. So there's a great sort of freedom that comes with it. And there's been a simultaneous movement in the U.S. and maybe here as well, people giving up possessions, giving up material goods and feeling very free by doing that. So I kind of wondered what some of your comments were on that. And just the second thing following up on that, I think there's a lack, I didn't hear enough about the background of the people in this church. It seems a little bit confusing to me anyway. Because it seems like on the one hand they're extremely wealthy, they're just not ordinary middle class, they're actually upper middle class. I mean, the real estate in that area is extremely expensive, and the jobs pay rather well. So are they people that lost their jobs? Is that why they have so much debt? is it their house, you know, their mortgage why they're in debt, or is it, you know, simply they're spending, they're starting off with a lot more than most people, actually, and also added to that, if they're working with that kind of money, they would be very tied into the larger financial system with their investments and so forth, so I'll leave it there.
I think starting with the Greg Smith scenario, I don't know if all of you read about that, but you know, so this high level executive basically defected from Goldman Sachs in spectacular fashion.
Was that yesterday?
By writing an op-ed in the New York Times about Goldman's profit-driven, client-hating culture, in which people who were doing deals with clients called them Muppets, which is the only clean word that is actually used in those situations, so therefore the only printable in the New York Times. So I think that what is continuous between that situation and the many characteristics of the financial crisis and the kind of critique that the evangelical ministries are making is that what they would say was what we were seeing is an excess of economic rationality, and economic rationality has become unmoored from any kind of other countervailing values. And so Greg Smith and his defection is saying that in fact that capitalism can't work without countervailing values even at the point of what should seem like it's most profit maximizing, that in fact caring for clients and not ripping them off, but actually caring them, in fact being a word that would be certainly available in this situation is being stewards of your clients' businesses, is the kind of ethic that should be practiced and promoted on Wall Street. What the problem is that actually that has been entirely driven out by a corporate culture that simply values making money over absolutely everything else. So I think that there is a kind of parallel there, certainly.
Two last questions. Just a quick question. Yeah.
What is their attitude to taxation, personal and corporate? Do they say, "Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's"?
And that's exactly what they said.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you. Very interesting. Interested in this question of value, and whether sort of linking into what you just said, actually, in terms of whether this, because value sort of has two meanings. In one sense, we talk about the value of money and of the value of, you know, of your house, and on the other hand, we talk about the value of friendship and family and all these things that can't be sort of precisely the opposite to the other kind of value, and how whether you can see this giving stewardship of your assets and the sort of value, the finite monetary value of those onto God as a way of reevaluating the value of the capitalist consumer society, in a way, placing the main value of things into fellowship and into God.